Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we will be talking about political reform broadly in the Arab world, but specifically in Egypt. And our guest for the program is Amr Hamzawi. He is a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a political scientist. He's also taught at Cairo University and also the Free University of Berlin, and has spent a lot of time following, thinking about the politics of the Middle East and looking specifically at the efforts of countries in Europe to promote political reform in the Middle East. Just a little bit more in terms of background on him. He received his PhD from the Free University of Berlin, where he worked at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies. He is also an external expert on Middle Eastern politics for the German Ministry of Economic Cooperation and Development, and is also widely published in both German and Arabic periodicals and media. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, you're certainly welcome to give us a call and participate in the conversation. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can get in as many as possible to keep the program moving. But certainly your calls and comments are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, you're calling from around Champaign or around Illinois and Indiana, not in the immediate area here, but in the larger area here in the Midwest. Or if you would happen to be listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use that toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Once again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Hamzawi, hello.
Yes, hi.
Thanks for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure to join you.
We appreciate it. I'm drawing on some comments that you made not very long ago, a couple of months ago in April, where you were appeared before the House Committee on International Relations, and you were talking about this very subject. And maybe we could talk in general terms a little bit first. You said that it was your feeling that in recent years, a number of Arab governments have indeed started down the road to reform, in large part because they were facing pressure from their own citizens. And while one might say that the pace has been slow, and slower than some people would like, that indeed there is movement, although perhaps there are some obstacles. And the major one I think that you mention here is the lack of broadly based democratic movements that can constitute a legitimate and effective kind of opposition to existing governments. But, you know, having said all that, maybe you can talk just a little bit more about the overall picture, looking at political reform in the Arab world.
Yes. Well, first of all, it's, as you said, it's extremely important to keep in mind that we do have unprecedented intensive movement in the region right now. Unprecedented as compared to the 1970s, 80s, and even the 1990s in terms of intensity and scope. Debates, discussions, but reform steps from governments all across the region are more focused and are more substantial, even as limited as they might be, more substantial as compared to the three decades from the 1970s up to the end of the 1990s. Second point is certainly even in countries like Jordan, Algeria, Yemen, Egypt, Kuwait, where you do have dynamics of democratic reform, these countries are far from being democratized. The respective regime can still be described as undemocratic, authoritarian, semi-authoritarian. Issues of governance, accountability, transparency, human rights are still missing to a great extent. So it's a process, it's a movement, but it's far from being complete. Third point, we have cases in the region where it looks worse. Take Syria, take a country like Libya, take like some of the Gulf countries, and excluding Iraq and Palestine, and these are exceptional cases out of different reasons. Take these countries, Syria, Libya, and some of the Gulf countries, and you will see no elements, no traces of a beginning democratization process. So we have these two patterns. We have the first pattern of countries moving, sometimes one step forward and two steps backward, but moving and generating new political interactions, and countries where, if you close your eyes, you feel as if you were in the 1960s or 1970s and no changes, whatever. Last point in terms of giving you an overview of what's happening in the region is it's important to keep in mind that it's not only about democratization and political change. We do have political conflicts as well in the region, and motivated out of different ethnic, religious, sectarian backgrounds. The potential of conflict in the region should not be ignored. We spent a great deal in the last couple of months talking about Arab Spring and an upcoming Arab democratization wave. It's important. There are signs. There are positive signs. But in order to keep it in context, we should focus and see the potential of conflicts out of distribution issues between Sunni and Shi'i populations in the Gulf, for example, out of sectarian issues in Lebanon. Sudan looks a bit better with a new constitution and the movement toward a transitional phase. Conflicts between rich and poor in a country like Egypt or in a country like Algeria. So you have a great potential for conflicts as well, and conflicts or potential of conflicts with missing democratic institutions ultimately lead to tensions, and it's what we see in different countries. So basically this is how I see the region right now.
People who are concerned with the movement towards democratic reform in the Arab world point to what has happened relatively recently in Eastern Europe, for example, and they say, if it can happen there in Europe, why not in the Middle East, in the Arab world? And obviously, every country is different from every other, yes, and parts of the world are different. There are important differences, so we can't overgeneralize. But perhaps though we can again ask a kind of a basic question that, yes, says, well, what are the significant differences? Say, what would be the significant differences between a Poland or, yes, or Czechoslovakia and Egypt or Syria or Jordan?
Sure. Let me. This is a very important question, and one of the questions which cannot be answered in a satisfactory way, because there are missing elements, and I will tell you why we do have or we do face missing elements in the region. Three major factors I see as relevant in terms of making out the difference between a country like Poland and a country like Egypt. One, political culture. In the region, and especially since the end of the Second World War and since the emergence of modern Arab nation states, Arab populations did not experience but authoritarian rule, did not experience but military regimes or conservative regimes which violated human rights, abused citizens, and did not respect their civil and political rights. However, frustrated Arab populations did not see the solution in democratic governance, did not see the solution in protest movements like in Eastern Europe paving the way for democratic transition, rather saw the solution in radical ideologies. I'm overgeneralizing, but this is basically the picture which you get out of the history of the region in the last 5 to 6 decades. They saw the solution in radical ideologies. The Islamic Republic of Iran inspired a great deal of religious movements in the region, which became very relevant in the 1980s and 1990s. Liberal democracy, liberal ideologies were discredited out of different reasons, partially out of Western policies in the Middle East and the Arab world and the issue of Israel and allegedly pro-Israeli American attitudes. And So we did have authoritarian rulers, and alternatives to them were not liberal democratic oriented in terms of public perceptions, were rather militant, radical as well, and democratic as well, but religious or Islamic inspired. Political culture. Second issue, the issue of the social structure of Arab societies as compared to Eastern European societies. Eastern European societies before 1989 were industrial societies. We did have middle classes in urban centers, especially, but even in rural areas. And, you know, the middle class has been historically the agent of democratic change, of liberal change, be it in Europe, in the 18th and 19th century, or elsewhere throughout the 20th century. In the Arab world, and here I'm generalizing a bit, but basically this is a picture which we get out of patterns of development throughout the last decades, middle classes are absent to a great extent in many Arab countries. Where they do exist, in a place like Egypt or in a place like Saudi Arabia, these are I would describe it as a middle strata which does not share the same values like European, Western European or Eastern European or even Latin American middle classes. Issues of freedom, human rights, transparency were not on their agenda for such a long time, and they were actually and are still to a great extent conservative oriented, religious inspired, Islamic inspired. Last point, and in order not to portray it as a contradiction between Islam or Islamic-inspired political culture and democracy or conservative middle classes, clearly what we did have in the region, and it's getting better a bit in countries like Egypt, Algeria, or Yemen, but it's still as bad as it was in the 1960s and 70s in a place like Syria or elsewhere. The security state, which emerged in the region, managed to not only to frustrate broad segments of the Arab population, but to create a sense of fear, a sense of being insecure when it comes to public authorities, and of they managed to portray distance or simply keeping out of public business or of public matters as the only solution to deal safely with the security apparatus of the respective state. So these are the basic differences which we do have, and they still exist. Although we have vibrant civil societies, we have protest movements which have been trying to create a degree of public awareness of democracy, but they are far from reaching the same level of Eastern European societies in 1988 or 89.
Let me ask one further question that's sure. of a little bit more general nature, and I think sure. that some people maybe would have made the argument that as governments in this region crack down on any and all dissent, that it actually opened the door to those people who did have the more radical ideologies, because it made it impossible for someone to organize if they wanted to organize along the lines of taking using liberal democratic political action that would have been perhaps of a more moderate nature, that because the government would not tolerate any dissent at all or any challenge at all, that they weakened the possibility of a more peaceful kind of democratic mm-hmm. change and opened the door to those people who would make the argument that the only way that political change can be achieved is through violence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You think that that is true?
It's certainly one side of the story, but it's only one side of the story, because if you and here I see historical and cross-cultural comparisons as extremely important to understand or to come to an understanding of the question what went wrong in Arab societies. If you look at Latin America, or you shift your attention to Africa or different Asian countries, we did have similar authoritarian security-driven regimes. And opposition to these regimes were not militant-oriented. To a great extent, they were liberal-oriented, and they called upon governments to retreat, to initiate liberal reforms, political reforms. Liberal democracy was basic source of inspiration for different opposition parties and movements in Latin America and elsewhere. So the existence of the regime and the fact that Arab regimes, security regimes, really, as you said, closed the public space in a way that did not give any organized power, even intellectuals or writers, did not leave space for them to articulate their opinions and to articulate alternatives, clearly led to the marginalization of these liberal voices, but does not explain the existence, the emergence, and the dominance to a great extent of radical and militant ideologies. So the second explanation is certainly political culture based, and here and it's a generalization, but I see it as relevant for the last 5 to 6 decades as well. Arab societies, modern Arab societies, did not manage to generate national consensus over the very crucial question of religion and politics. Which role does Islam or does religion play in public life? Which role does or should Islam play in the political sphere? And what does citizenship mean? What does the civil character of politics mean as opposed to religious inspired understanding of politics? This question of religion and politics, religion and society, whether religion within society or over society as a dominating, determining force, this question was not tackled. Or if it was tackled or has been tackled, it did not generate national consensus over how to approach it. And this is why, if you look at the Arab scene right now, you see, be it governments or be it opposition forces or intellectuals or writers, you see this kind of very disturbing movement between different ideological frameworks, and you don't know really what you should expect, whether they call for political reforms and they stand to it, or whether they will call today for political reform and shift to a different perception of politics if they come to power or if they become a key political actor. So this is the second aspect of reality which explains, at least to an extent, the difference between non-Arab experiences, non-Western, non-Arab experiences in Latin America or Asia or Africa and the reality of the Arab world. Lastly, I see, and this is a very motivating development, I see signs of an emerging national consensus in a place like Egypt or in a place like Lebanon where the central issue of religion and politics is being tackled. If you look at Egypt right now, even the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the central, most powerful religious-inspired movement, they are adopting a clear discourse on the civility of politics, on the centrality of citizenship understood along non-religious, non-sectarian lines, and on a separation between religion and politics, even if they keep up the rhetoric of Islamic State. When it comes to real politics, they play the game in a different way. Similar signs can be found in Lebanon as well. But we are yet to see whether it's going to become a stable national consensus and generate acceptance across the respective society or not. We have to wait.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Emer Hamzawi. He is an Egyptian political scientist. He's taught at Cairo University and also the Free University of Berlin. He is now a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and is particularly interested in the changing dynamics of political participation in the Arab world, including the role of Islamist opposition groups, paying particular attention to both Egypt and the countries of the Gulf. Questions are welcome. In fact, we have one. We'll get right to 333-9455 is our Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have someone here local to begin with in Champaign County, and it's line number one. Hello.
Thank you. I wanted to point out that there are some the Middle East is not so exceptional in some regards. The way the secular left and opposition, which is not doesn't sum it up entirely, was extirpated in Latin America, forced a lot of the opposition into the church, and then we had the whole liberation theology and the orthodoxy, non-orthodoxy kind of arguments going on. So I just think that's not not so exceptional as some people make it out. An example of this being done is when Israel supported Hamas as a counterbalance to the secular PLO. I mean, this is an emblem for what has been done in a lot of ways. Where I mean, obviously, other places where secularism was the rule, but I mean, the manipulation was still even being done below the surface. But I didn't actually hear the first couple of minutes, so maybe you led with this. But it seems to me the whole idea that the democratic process, as it's being called in Egypt, which requires signatures from 600 government officials for someone to get on the ballot, it just doesn't meet the laugh test. And if you have an entrenched political party, a reality, as in Egypt, and then you can't vote for anybody unless they've gotten 600 signatures from government officials, you know, this is, I mean, all I can do is laugh. And the way people have been taking it seriously, and Laura Bush going there and congratulating, saying, well, it has to be tweaked. Well, it doesn't have to be tweaked. It has to be made all really authentic. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Well, we have, as folks know, if they've been with us from the beginning here, we started out talking a bit in general terms, but we do want to talk specifically about Egypt. So I'm glad that the caller raised the question. You can go ahead and you want to make some comments on what the caller had to say.
Yes, and let me tackle the first point briefly, because it's valid. Certainly in Latin America, but even in Eastern Europe, religious institutions, churches played a crucial role in inspiring emerging democratic opposition movements. The basic difference is, however, if you compare religious institutions in Latin America and Eastern Europe of the 1980s and 1990s to religious institutions in the Arab world, you will immediately figure out the basic difference, which is religious institutions in the Arab world, religious voices in the Arab world, have long ignored liberal democracy as an option. They portrayed, articulated different models for society and politics. Now, as I said, when it comes to the Muslim Brotherhood or other moderate voices within the Islam spectrum and slowly official religious institutions condemning violence or calling for liberal democratic reforms, yes, there is a shift, but it's happening now. And as compared to Latin America and Eastern Europe, it's different. The commitment to liberal democracy by religious voices, scholars, and institutions. Now, in Egypt, and I agree with the caller on his point, it's difficult to portray what happened in Egypt in terms of the constitution amendment. You know, President Mubarak initiated the constitution amendment last February. After discussions in the parliament and after a public referendum, it was accepted. And if you look at what was amended, the idea was to open up presidential elections for multiple candidates. If you look at the caveats, at the real conditions which are in the text of the constitutional amendment, you totally get a different the different impression of more restrictions and more limitations, and actually ruling out the possibility of any serious competition against Mubarak or any serious opposition campaign to contest Mubarak's power and his dominance in the Egyptian scene. Clearly, this is far away from being a serious, substantial political reform, but what's important to keep in mind as well is the fact that the amendment and the debates which we have been witnessing in Egypt since last February up to the last couple of weeks, the scale of protest movements, of opposition activities, has increased a great deal, the intensification of political interactions. All of these phenomena came up with Mubarak's plan to amend the constitution. So the output, the outcome, is certainly far away from being a complete or substantial political reform. But at least the image of the state, the image of the ruling elite, of the regime, as being unwilling to initiate any reforms is gone. The image of Mubarak's power as being uncontested and no opposition, whatever, is gone. You have on a daily basis demonstrations and rallies against Mubarak and the NDP, the ruling National Democratic Party. And thirdly, the dynamics of the scene are changing. It will take time, and we have to keep the issue of graduality in mind. And certainly, without wide-scale opposition movements, a government will never be strategically committed to political reforms. They have to be pressed, and opposition movements have to press on Mubarak and on the NDP to move forward. But movements are taking place. This is a crucial point.
It does seem to be difficult to see or to gauge the possibilities for change or to believe that there could be substantial change when you look at a place where the ruling party seems so firmly in control and has been for such a long time. Hosni Mubarak has been president for 24 years.
Right.
He's talking about running again, and there's some talk about grooming his son as a successor, which makes it start to look like a dynasty.
Yes.
You set that alongside what the ruling party is trying to, as you point out, trying to style itself as or restyle itself as being a party of reform.
Yes.
Given the reality that any talk about being a party of reform doesn't quite seem to square with what's really going on.
Sure. Let me tell you that I do see rhetoric as relevant when it comes to the political scene in Egypt, as limited as it is, and you are perfectly right to point out to all restrictions, limitations, and actually odds of the Egyptian system and the dominance of the president and of the ruling party. But the fact that they are moving, the ruling elite is moving or has been moving in the direction of portraying itself as a reform power, as a reform actor, as a key player for political reforms, at the end of the day commits the ruling party and commits the president to a degree of initiating a process of political reform. Certainly what's intended, and this is a well-known strategy, is not more than cosmetic changes. So you say, I'm going to amend the constitution and open up presidential elections for multiple candidates, and at the end of the day, you have caveats which rule out the possibility of any serious competition. You say, I'm going to reform laws and regulations governing political parties and political participation, and you substitute names and labels, and at the end of the day, you have the same restrictive approach to it. You say, pluralistic parliamentary elections, but monitored, but you refuse international monitoring. So yes, certainly there are different contradictions here, but rhetoric commits the government and the ruling elite to actions in a more midterm, long-term perspective. Secondly, and here we have to shift attention from the state and from the ruling elite to the society as such, to opposition movements and opposition dynamics. Certainly what happened in Egypt in the last 2 years, especially in the last couple of months, did inspire opposition movements to go out to streets in Cairo, Alexandria, and other cities, and even in rural areas to demonstrate, to try to articulate national alliances, to coordinate between them, as different as they might be, from liberal, leftist to Islamist, to try to unify, to come to a unified agenda, to call on the government to implement concrete, specific political reforms in a specific time frame. So these opposition dynamics, all of them came out with changes initiated by the state. And this is not a critique on, or as far as the opposition is concerned, but this is simply the logic of authoritarian regimes. States, ruling elites are key players. You cannot do away with them. You need them to initiate, to start the process, and then the dynamics of the process itself might take it far away from the intentions of the ruling elite or from their interest only in cosmetic reforms. So we should not look at it as a question of either or we should not tackle it as a question of what's happening right now, but rather as a process where we need to keep in mind the gradual and historical perspective. I am Egyptian myself, and I would love to see my country fully democratized, but it will take time. It will take time, and this is my assessment as a political scientist.
All right, let's talk with someone else. We have a listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hello. I just started listening, so maybe this topic's already come up. I was wondering how seriously Nawal Saadawi's campaign is being taken. I understand that she was running for president, according to Democracy Now!, or at least trying to get to run for president. But obviously, you know, you need to be already in the ruling elite. So is that kind of effort of any value, do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Is she still running or trying to get on the ballot? And I just wonder what the role of someone like that is, if they can have any influence about opening up the electoral system.
Well, Nawal Saadawi, and she is, as you know, as the caller knows, a well-known female activist in Egypt. And as you know, she has been very outspoken in relation to women, their status, political and civil rights, and even issues of religious perceptions on woman-man relationship and equality. And so she's a very important voice, a very important liberal voice, which we do have in Egypt. Her intentions to run as an independent candidate are not going to materialize in candidacy, out of the caveats which we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
According to the Constitution Amendment, you need such a big number of signatures from members of the parliament or of local councils to support your candidacy as independent politician, and both the parliament and local councils are over to 90% controlled by the NDP, by the ruling National Democratic Party. So at the end of the day, it rules out, the amendment rules out the possibility of independent candidates running for presidency. However, someone like Nawal Saadawi or Saadin Ibrahim, a sociology professor who announced his intention to run as well, the relevance of their announcements, of their plans, is more directed to the public space itself, to Egyptian citizens, to make citizens aware that we do have alternatives to Mubarak, but that the system itself, as it looks right now, prevents any serious competition, prevents independent candidates from running, permits opposition figures from opposition parties to run, even with restrictions, but permits them to run. But the system itself rules out alternative options. And this awareness is extremely important for Egyptian citizens to know that if they press more, if they call for more reforms, it might look different, not this year, but maybe in 2 years from now. It might look different, not in relation to presidential elections, but certainly in relation to parliamentary elections. So this kind of pointing out to possibilities which might exist if we move ahead is extremely important. And lastly, Nawal Saadawi's voice is important because it balances she and other voices, female voices, balance a bias which exists in the Egyptian public space toward more conservative society and political perception. So it's important to have an outspoken liberal voice.
Okay, and also you say she's an important voice, but is she actually really read in Egypt, or would you say that her editorials and that kind of work is read more than her literary work?
Well, she is well read in Egypt among
intellectuals,
among specific segments of educated young Egyptians, more female than male young Egyptians. So she is well read, relatively speaking. And I guess it's the picture which you get in every society. I mean, you have segments which get interested in specific issues, and they read available literature. Nawal Saadawi's literary work is, and this is a trend which exists in Egypt, unfortunately, has been losing its importance throughout the last years out of different economic, cultural, and social factors. Egyptians, to a great extent, are losing interest in literary work and are more focused on media stuff, which is a global trend as well. They are losing interest in treatments or books which tackle issues of civil rights, political rights, if a and Nawal Saadawi does it in this way, if these works tackle these issues in a very abstract, more normative, ideological way, they are more interested in daily life, in daily politics. And this is why her literary work has been losing importance, and what she writes for newspaper editorials and op-ed pieces are very well read, again, among these two segments, intellectuals and educated young female.
Was she more popular, like, in the 80s? Because
what Nawal Saadawi stands for, and she represents a generation of female activists and writers across the region, not only in Egypt. Their literature was very popular in the 1970s and 1980s, but these were different decades. They were authoritarian when it comes to political life, but they were very enlightened and liberal-oriented in terms of public culture. We still had up to end of the 1980s a core leftist intellectual movement across the region from Morocco to Bahrain, which produced literature that was well read across the region. The shift, which took place especially in the 1990s, from liberal leftist ideologies to more Islamic or Islamist views of society and politics, resulted in less importance or less focus or interest in relation to Nawal Saadawi and her work.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We are headed here about into our last 15 minutes, and I'd like to introduce once again our guest. We're speaking with Dr. Amer Hamzawi. He is a senior associate in Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Was educated both in Egypt, where he grew up, and also in Europe. He received his PhD from the Free University of Berlin, and he has taught both at Cairo University and the Free University in Berlin. He's particularly interested in political participation in the Arab world, how that is changing, the role of Islamist opposition groups, and particularly is interested in specifically in Egypt and the countries of the Gulf. And we're talking here broadly about political reform in the Arab world, but specifically about Egypt. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just to go back for a moment to something that you touched on earlier, I'm looking here at some comments that were made to the BBC, to a reporter of the BBC, by one of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, Muhammad al-Sayyid Habib, who said that he says, quote, "We believe in democracy and political pluralism. What we want is civilian rule within an Islamic framework." And then he goes on to say something like, he says, "There should be no contradiction between democracy and Sharia, and Islamic law." And I certainly am not intending to criticize him or the party or anybody else. But I'm going back to the questions that people sometimes raise when opposition groups say, "What we want is peaceful political change. We want democracy. We want pluralism." One wonders what happens when, if indeed they should achieve power, would they still have the same same commitment to political pluralism?
Sure. Well, you are raising one of the questions which we keep encountering here in Washington, but elsewhere, when it comes to Islamists, their perceptions of politics and their commitment to democratic procedures, norms and values, whether they will stick to them if they become key players or if they come to power or not. And this is more than a legitimate question out of two good reasons. One, we did have negative historical experiences in the 1990s, especially in Algeria. An Islamist opposition movement which gained a majority in parliamentary elections, and the first thing which the leader of the movement did was to announce that democracy is not, or democratic rules are not binding for the movement. And this, among other factors, created the whole negative development in Algeria and the civil war, which lasted for almost a decade. And the second good reason for keeping or at least addressing the issue of whether they are going to be committed or not, it certainly is a question of the discourse, the ideology and the rhetoric of these movements. These are movements which are religious-based, religious-inspired, as you quoted Habib, who is the second man of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. The issue of Islamic law, of Sharia, of religion is central, as a central framework. Doubts everyone, liberal, leftist, or non-Muslim citizen of Egypt or Syria or elsewhere, legitimate doubts will immediately emerge out of, well, if Islam is a framework of politics and society, what is the status of non-Muslim communities? What are the patterns of treating them, of engaging them? Are they going to be considered citizens or citizens of second class? Or what kind of differences in civil and political rights are we going to have? So doubts are legitimate. Now, as I see the spectrum of Islamist movements in the region, I see clearly two trends or two trajectories. One, the one which Habib's quotation really reflects, which is they are opening up. They are gradually, and I stress gradually, opening up in the direction of embracing democratic procedures, democratic rules of the game, which is power sharing, peaceful competition over political power, power rotation through the ballot. And they are opening up, gradually opening up in this direction. And I see two factors as relevant here, why they open up. One, Islamists suffered more than any other opposition movement in the region from repressive regimes. So they have a substantial interest in minimizing the scope of state repression. Secondly, they are getting rid of their radical militant fantasies of the 1980s and 1990s of establishing Islamic states and republics because it led them nowhere. So they are becoming more moderate. So this is a trend, the first trend which Habib's quotation reflects. And here it's important to take it seriously, to believe in them, to believe in this opening up, with all due doubts and attention to potential contradictions and ambivalences. And more important is, it's important to keep in mind that we need constitution arrangements. If they are to be integrated in the political scene in a country like Egypt, or where they are integrated in Morocco or Jordan, we need constitution arrangements. They have to abide to democratic rules. They can keep up the rhetoric with its focus on Islamic states as rhetoric. But when it comes to political interactions, to the political games, they have to abide and to act according to democratic rules. The second trend is an opposite trend, which is a trend of radicalization within the Islamist spectrum as well. And this is a trend at the outer edges of the spectrum. So Bin Laden, Zarqawi in Iraq, and the other, actually in Arabic they sound extremely frightening, these names, and these other splinter groups which have been using violence throughout the last years to reach what they call political objectives. So we have these two trends, moderation, pragmatism on the one side, and radicalization on the other side. I see the first trend as dominant, but it depends on political openings in general. If you integrate them, if you get them in with constitution arrangements, with all kinds of guarantees, you give them more space to articulate more moderate visions of politics and society. If you exclude them and keep them out of the scene, of the political scene, and ban them, radicalization is the major outcome.
We are coming down again to our last 10 minutes here. We have some other callers. We'll try to get them in. The next is listening this morning in Indiana, in Edwardsport, Indiana, on our toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hi. I just had a quick comment and a question. It seems like that the West wants a quick fix at democracy over there, and the in our beginning of our democracy, it was only the white men that could vote. Therefore, it was the ruling party. I think my question is, do you think that if we took a more moderate and slower view of them letting them gradually get democracy, that it would be easier for the Arab countries to gain this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess your question raises the issue of how far can external actors or external forces influence democratization processes in a region far away from the West. Far away, not in a cultural sense, but geographically, and far away in terms of public perceptions of Arab majorities, which are very critical of the West, especially of the U.S. Now, I see two points as relevant here. One, democratization processes never happen out of external democracy promotion. Regardless how much the U.S. or Europe are going to invest, might be willing to invest in democracy promotion, if you do not have internal dynamics, and especially if you do not have broad based opposition movements calling upon authoritarian rulers to democratize and making authoritarian governance costly for them, you will never reach the level of starting and initiating dynamics, substantial dynamics of political reform. It's happening, as I said, in the region, exactly out of this combination of broad opposition movements and authoritarian rulers willing to compromise a bit. And here, and this is my second point, certainly I'm not ruling out democracy promotion from the West. It's important. It's crucial, but it cannot initiate the process or generate the process on its own. It's needed to assist opposition movements to move forward, to create more space for them, to press on governments, to ease restrictions on opposition movements, to articulate liberal views and to practice politics, needed to encourage and persuade governments to move ahead. Lastly, your question on gradualism and pace and scope of political reform. One of the arguments which especially Arab rulers keep using is the one on particularity. They will tell you, well, Arab societies are different, they are particular, and what happened in the West cannot be copied here, and we have our own path to democracy, Egyptian, Saudi, Syrian, whatever. Now, the question is, certainly each society is particular if compared to any other society anywhere. And you can even be more accurate and say even in every society you have local regions, you have regions which are particular. However, it's an instrumentalization of the issue of particularity and of the so-called Arab path to democracy. Democracy, democratization means an agreement, consensus on rules of the game, how to make politics, how to play politics. You reach it in different ways, and you reach it according to different processes. But we have to agree on the rules of democratized political spheres look similar in the U.S., in Europe, and in the Arab world. What might differ is the way to democracy, but not the output, not the end station on a very long road. Can be a very long road in a society like Saudi Arabia, maybe a bit shorter in Egypt. Yes, here I agree, but the outcome is universal. These are universal values: freedom, equality, representation, civil and political rights.
I want to thank the caller for a question. I really appreciate her asking it, because this was something I wanted to make sure we tried to touch on.
Sure.
Before we finish. That is the issue of whether any external pressure or assistance can help in democratic reform. Now, I'm at the point here where I may have maybe 1 or 2 minutes left, but I'm certainly interested in having you talk for a little bit.
Yes.
About the differences, and I know this is something that you're particularly interested in, the differences between the kind of approach that European governments have taken, mm-hmm. and that the United States has taken.
Yes. Well, on Europe first, you know, the European Union since mid-90s is engaged with the region, with Arab countries in the context of the so-called Barcelona process, Euro-Mediterranean Partnership. And this is a partnership since 1995 for economic, cultural, and political issues. So Europe started earlier as compared to the U.S. Second difference, Europe has focused throughout the last 10 years mainly on economic and cultural issues out of the understanding of you need to create a framework where you can discuss democracy. And creating the framework means to homogenize, to create a better scope of pluralism in the economy when it comes to cultural issues, and then you can move to tackle the critical issues of politics and political representation and political power. The U.S. started the other way around. The U.S. started after 9/11 out of good reasons, which I'm not going to repeat here, started the other way around from political reforms. The focus is on political reform. Thirdly, and here Europe and the U.S. are basically acting the same way, it's still much of rhetoric and much less or much more of rhetoric as compared to actions. Rhetoric here in Washington and in every European capital sounds great. It's exactly what Arab opposition, liberal, democratic opposition movements are calling for. But actions differ. Actions look different out of strategic considerations, out of the variety of regimes which we have in the region, and the variety of interests which the U.S. and Europe do have in the region as well. Finally, external democracy promotion, as limited as it is right now, and as I said, rhetoric counts more as compared to actions. However, with taking all these limitations into considerations, external democracy promotion was instrumental in the last 2 years in helping Arab liberal opposition, be it parties or movements, to be more outspoken on democratic reforms. Clearly, the international environment out of European and American democracy promotion activities looks different to Arab opposition movements as compared to the 1980s and 1990s. There is a degree of international legitimacy for calling upon rulers to limit their powers, to make concessions, to retreat, to leave space for political movements to move in the respective national scene. So the international legitimacy has been very instrumental in pushing Arab opposition movements, liberal opposition movements, to be more outspoken on reform. So it's important and should be kept up. But as I said, at the end of the day, Egyptians, Lebanese, Yemeni, Syrian citizens are going to press on their governments to initiate democratic reforms, substantial democratic reforms, or not. If they will continue to press, certainly democracy will be in the reach, and very soon, historically speaking. If they give it up and start looking for, as I say it, misleading alternatives in radical ideologies or in hatred campaigns, we will go nowhere.
All right. There we will leave it. Our guest, Amer Hamzawi, he is Senior Associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And Dr. Hamzawi, thank you very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.